Rough Trade is giving away a third of the first 3 months of the Rough Trade Club plus new music membership exclusively to 101 Part-Time Jobs listeners. Become a member of Rough Trade Club New Music and you'll receive the Rough Trade Album of the Month straight to your door every month on an exclusive vinyl pressing with bonus material. Club members have received exclusive pressings of albums from Sufjan Stevens, Sprints, The Last Dinner Party, English Teacher, and Over Mono, just to name a few, this past year alone. Sign up using the promo code CLUB101POD and you'll get Rough Trade's Album of the Month, Camera Obscura's Look to the East, Look to the West, for a third of the usual price. By signing up, you'll be getting Rough Trade's exclusive issue of the album on opaque purple in a gatefold sleeve, plus a bonus CD containing 5 demos. Don't want the album of the month but still want all the benefits? Sign up to the standard tier using CLUB101POD and you'll still get the first month free. You'll also get free shipping on all orders, 10% off at the bar and on secondhand vinyl in store, and exclusive access to sold out Rough Trade events. So don't hang around. Head to roughtrade.com/club and sign up with the code CLUB101POD. That's CLUB101POD and claim money off Rough Trade's Album of the Month today. This offer is for UK residents only. Do you play in bands? I did for the longest time, and I wish that I knew that DistroKid was a thing. I don't even think it existed back then. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all the major streaming services. When you get DistroKid, you can see a DistroKid bank and withdraw your earnings. You get notified when you've earned royalties and you can withdraw via the app. And you can even check your streaming stats on Spotify and Apple. Get 30% off your first year on DistroKid by going to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. 30% off for your first year. That's not bad. We know it's a tough world out there. Why don't you make it easier for yourself? And to get 30% off that free year as an artist, where you get 100% of your royalties and earnings, go to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. All right, stay with me. I'll be right back after this. You're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs, where I speak to bands about the other jobs they've done. And I've got Frank Lees from Press Club, Melbourne, Australia's Press Club, with me here. And he's going to tell us about the jobs he's had, including one at a bar where no one ever came into, one working with kids doing history reenactments, and a couple of other brilliant stories. It's Hassle Records' 15th anniversary this month, and they're reissuing Late Teens, originally out in 2019, and they're releasing that on mint and crystal clear half and half vinyl. Pre-order that now through Hassle's website. East London's Signature Brew have been brewing music-inspired beers since 2011. They've brewed beers with the likes of Mastodon, Idols, Slaves, recently Sports Team. And if you go onto their website, if you live in the UK and want to buy some of their beers, go onto their website, signaturebrew.co.uk, and use the voucher code 101podcast at checkout and get 10% off. All right, here's Frank Lees from Press Club. Enjoy it. Go well. Cheers.
It's funny, isn't it? It's like, it's funny that question when people ask you, you know, what do you do? Because it's a lot more complicated than just like, oh yeah, I work down at the bank or something like that. It's like, I mean, I always say I'm a musician, right? Obviously, there's not heaps of money in that. So people are generally asking like, oh yeah, and what else, you know, what else do you do? Or sometimes they just assume that that's enough to bring in the bills, you know? So it's kind of always a bit of an awkward moment, you know. Like I've grown more comfortable with it as I've grown older, but it is strange that you know, what do you do, you know, what do you do? You speak to some people sometimes and, you know, you say to them, what do you do, and they almost get like offended.
Yeah.
You know that reaction.
Someone tweeted the other day about how, you know, in Britain at least, there's this kind of thing where you shouldn't be too proud about working hard. Do you know what I mean? No one likes hearing about how someone else has worked so hard, which is, when you think about it, that's mad. Like, what else are we supposed to do? Just like half-ass it the whole time, like crapshoot it, you know, and just like phone it in for our whole lives.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult space, isn't it? You know, like sometimes that's what people do though, you know, like they go to work, they can't count down the minutes until they can leave work, and you know, they put in, you know, just as much effort as they need to. And you know, like I kind of get that, you know, that it sounds like a nightmare to be honest, but if you can deal with it, you know, putting in that much time and not really engaging, you know, you live your life outside of those hours, I suppose.
For real. And I find that interesting when it's applied to being in bands, because especially punk rock bands, you don't look like you're trying too much, you know, which is mad to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You put a lot of work into seeming like you're not trying too hard, but I mean, you know, do it yourself and, you know, getting things done without anybody else's help is a big part of the punk rock ethos, I think. So I don't really have too much of a problem of people seeing us, you know, work.
Yeah.
You know, but it's sort of, you know, you don't want to be that sort of glissy, you know, like glamorous sort of, you don't want to put across the wrong vibe, you know?
Right. And I think it's fascinating. Like, so, you know, when that boils down to things you actually do, say you're getting a photo of your band, you know, you might have a photographer friend and the photos come out really glissy, you know, they come out really kind of like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like poppy or something like this, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because that's always going to precede people's opinions of you.
I know. Photo shoots as a band is just funny in the first place, man. Like, it's like, you know, like trying to explain to somebody who's not in a band, like what a photo shoot is like, or someone who doesn't do photo shoots, you know, trying to explain to them what a photo shoot is like. It's like fire, especially like you go to like a location photo shoot, like, you know, that classic thing, like you go to like a park or something, or like, you know, something cool in the local area and there are just people walking past. You know, that vibe. And you're just like, oh man, what an absolute idiot I must look like. Like, look, what a tryhard I am.
I mean, videos are just as bad, right?
Yeah. Oh man. Doing it. Yeah. Yeah, they are. They are. I mean, videos are maybe the hardest part about being in a band, I think.
You've got some great videos as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've worked hard at it, like I said, you know, but it's funny. The best videos tend to be the ones that you kind of just fall into, you know.
100%. I think there is something to say for like those accidents that just work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we did this, the very first video we did for our very first single. It's called Head Wreck, and it's this really cool.
Yeah, great song.
Yeah, and the video is maybe still one of our favorite videos, if not my favorite video of ours, where
100%.
it's all one continuous shot. And it was our mate Nick Manuel, who is a musician and he does video stuff, and photography too. He was in the studio with us when we were recording and came up with this idea as just like a one continuous shot. And it was just this sort of thing where it's like, oh yeah, that sounds really cool. And then we just booked in the place and then we just did it a couple of weeks after recording, and it was great, you know, perfect.
Excellent. And straightforward by the sounds of it. And there's something to say for him being around when you were recording it and when it was coming together and, you know, having that kind of that energy kind of shared between you at that time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, that was what was all part of it. You know, that was what made the video what it was.
It must be hard when you do something like that and it's like pretty straightforward. You know what you're doing. It comes together quickly and it comes together well, because that's not going to happen every time.
It's a nightmare. That's why I say, man, like trying to do videos, like trying to get videos together for your song, it's so important because it's what people engage with the most almost now is video, you know, video content, moving picture. So you need that to go with your music, but it's such a headache to try and get a video together, man. Like, that's the part where what we were talking about before, where we were saying, you know, you don't want to give across the wrong image. That's the moment where it's easiest to put across the wrong vibe when you're making a video.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always, we're writing music now for an album that we'll hopefully record, you know, when we can get back together. And, you know, just in the back of my mind, I know we're going to have to do some videos for these songs. And it's just that worry in the back of my head. Like, I know it's going to come up, and it's going to be such a drainer when it happens.
But music is so symbiotic to online content now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Like, you can't ignore it. And, you know, I feel like, well, you've either got to enjoy it or just not do it, you know? And I wonder if, you know, is that a decision for you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy to rationalize it that way. But then when you've got three other people who all have ideas for what the video should look like, and then, you know, maybe bringing on a someone to film it and to sort of, you know, inject their personality into it as well. It just seems to be just for us, it just seems to be just a constant headache. You know, the best ones though, with that being said, we did this video for Behave, which is quite a recent single, where we just took, what is it? I think it's just some footage of Ian's dad from the 70s. Ian's our bass player. His dad in the 70s, some home video, and then some live footage of ours. And then we just mashed them on top of each other. And, you know, it was just, we didn't have to actually film anything. We were just using already existing footage. I think we filmed a few shots of Nat like singing just to tie it together. And again, it all came together, and that was like one of my favorite clips. Maybe it's one of my favorite clips because we didn't have to actually put too much, thought into like a story or a narrative for it.
Yeah. And that makes me wonder. I mean, it's come up quite a few times of on the conversations I've had with people on this podcast, where it just takes time, and I'm talking years, to figure out what works for you and to figure out what you like, and, you know, the aesthetics that you want to put across. That all takes so much time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it does. And I think we were really lucky when we first started this band, in that we had just, we'd all just sort of come out of other long-term band, arrangements. And when we came together, we had that time, you know, we had no gigs booked, and we specifically didn't book any gigs, to just write music and try and talk about what we think a good band would do and would be. And those ideas that we came up with at the time have really carried through, you know, like those foundational concepts are still, you know, we still go back to that sort of stuff. And it was all about, trying to be as naturalistic as possible. Try not to play into the game as much as we had in the past. You know, the music game.
Which is
easy
to do. Easy to slip into that.
Oh man. And you know, like try and like you see it. I don't know how often you see it in other countries, because I mean we're so insular here in Australia. But you see bands like writing music for, like writing music and then getting producers in to try and fit into a particular sound.
For Triple J, or
I wasn't going to say it, but you did. You know, it's almost sacrilege to start ragging on Triple J here, but it's true, man. Triple J is like, it really has cornered the market on independent bands like us. And if you don't play into that sound and that vibe, then you know, you can get left behind.
I spent some time in Australia, and it was funny seeing the bands that we were playing with, like if you get on Triple J a few times,
absolutely, yeah. If you know, a lot of doors open up, you know, if you get like played on that station, you do get gigs and stuff. What would you recommend to listen to? Like where would you say that like radio are a way of finding good music in
100% Six Music on BBC. So Steve Lamacq.
Yep.
He was the guy that like broke like all like way more even bands that's like worth us mentioning here, like going back to Manic Street Preachers and even like Coldplay. You know, he was the guy going to their first gigs and receiving their first demos. He's a legend. He's played like a bunch of us and our friends' bands over the years, and he's amazing to listen to because, you know, as far as radio goes, it's just about the music, and he's chatting to people and having a laugh. I would say Six Music is Six the place music. To yeah. Radio One is like playing a lot more guitar bands. They've got someone called Jack Saunders doing the indie show, and he's playing a lot of great new stuff. You know, you do get these moments, and you know, because it's, I don't know, I was interviewing someone yesterday and I was like, wasn't 2005 such a golden time for music? And for us it was, right? But like the world has to keep on going, and we have to we have to find out for ourselves, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to sit around and be like, you know, grumpy about it. Like, what's the point of that?
Yeah, man. Like, what's happening? Are we just getting old? Are we just out of the loop? So. You know.
I think so. So you mentioned that like Press Club started after, you know, a bunch of your old bands sort of stopped or became inactive. That must have been such a great time to have that kind of non-pressure, especially with the internet now. You know, not having to sort of make an account straight away and give yourselves time to, well, as you said, kind of figure out what you want to do.
Yeah. It was really important. And it's funny, you know, we were planning on having a third album written and recorded by like April this year. And obviously that hasn't happened.
That's quick. That's footloose, man. That's quick feet.
Yeah. But that hasn't happened, obviously. And I think at least I am just so grateful that we've had the time yet again to really sit back and think about things again, you know, like, because this is the first time really that we've gone this long without playing a gig and without, you know, rehearsing or anything like that. So it's been such a great time of, you know, just talking over Zoom and just thinking about what it is that we want to do going forward, you know. And like, because I mean, as a musician, you don't want to admit it, but every once in a while you go, do I want to be doing this? Do I want to spend like my, like every single weekend going to other cities and playing gigs? Do I want to like be leaving my family and friends like and going to Europe two or three times a year? Like, is this actually giving me joy? Because sometimes it certainly doesn't. And this time that we've had where we haven't been able to do that stuff has, you know, reminded me just how much I love it, you know, and just what a big part of my life it is.
Yeah, totally. I think you can, it's, you know, from my experience, it's quite easy to just kind of, when you're all wrapped up in it, you know, you can't, everything, it's pretty easy to feel like numb. Do you know what I mean? You're not even sure like what you're doing. You know, you're just doing it for the sake of doing it, it feels like sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure everybody gets like that, you know?
Yeah.
But it's harder when you're doing something and you like playing music, which, you know, doesn't bring in a lot of money into your life and you're spending lots of time doing it. You know, it takes up a lot of time, but it's not that profitable. certainly not for us. And so, you know, there is some pretty big questions to ask yourself there.
What do you do aside from the band?
Okay, that's what this is all about, isn't it?
But honestly, I like sometimes I'll have whole episodes, Frank, where I even forget to ask it. You know, that is just an excuse for me to chat to bands that I like.
Oh, that's good. I mean, man, I've had such a... The reason why I put my hand up to do this one, because when I thought about it, I was like, far out, man. I've never had like an actual like salary job. I've never had like a part-time or full-time job. I've always worked casually.
Great.
Right at this moment, I'm not working at all because this lockdown thing in Melbourne's pretty serious, and I'm getting money through my business, the band business, through the government.
Yeah, right. Like, so I want to ask you about that in a bit, actually.
Yeah. We can talk about it now if you want. We can go back to my job. My job's in the past later.
Well, how does that work then? Because I've interviewed the Beths.
Okay.
Is it a pretty similar situation?
I don't know what's going on in New Zealand, but in Australia, there's like a, I mean, they've doubled, you know, like unemployment benefits. And then they've also done this like extra thing where it's called JobKeeper, and they pay businesses to continue paying their staff even if the money's not coming in. So we've been able to claim through the band this JobKeeper payment.
Oh, right. So the JobKeeper applies to you as a... So yeah. It works in Australia in the way that, you know, you apply for a... Would you call it a grant?
It's... Yeah, it's handled... It's not quite a grant. It's a... It's like a... It's like a benefit, you know. It's you apply through it. You apply directly to the taxation office, and then they pay you.
Right. And so, how easy was that to set up, and sort of, you know, how many do you have to release a couple of albums, and, you know, sort of show that you've toured quite a lot before you can apply for that?
No, it was the only prerequisite for it was that you had to have a business, obviously, and that you made 30% less income for a month. it's quite complicated. You got to go. You go and check out your income for, say, for March this year, and then you go back to the year before, 2019. And if the income is 30% less than it was in March last year, then you qualify.
Which is going to happen if you've just started your band and you've left your old job.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's yeah, it was easy for me to get, but, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of hoops that the government is making people jump through that means that some people can't get it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, things like this, once you get it, sometimes it's so easy, and other, you know, and you hear about for other people it's so hard, but it happened pretty quickly for Press Club then.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know.
Great.
It's a really good scheme, you know. I think that's one thing the Australian government has done really well, is just they've just been paying people, you know. They haven't been stingy with those benefits and sort of keeping businesses afloat, you know. It's really important.
When you got that scheme, did that give you like an impetus to be like, okay, let's make a few albums over the next 5-10 years, let's do this properly?
Well, I mean, we're already doing it properly, you know. What it meant is that we've been able to put a lot more time into the writing aspect, you know. So instead of having, say, we usually try and write as many ideas before going in and sort of working it out for an album as possible, but instead of having like 20 or 30 ideas, now we've probably got almost 100, I reckon.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's and, a lot,
know,
isn't it?
We're going to whittle that, and it's quite daunting, you know, because then we have to whittle all that down to like an album that'll fit on an actual record.
Which is interesting, because a lot of people will, you know, have these jobs and they'll have to fit in writing around that. Yeah. Does it put on a bit of extra pressure because you've got all this time?
Yeah, I try not to give into pressure too much. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, I've always kind of been of the mindset of, you know, if you just go through the steps of getting things done, then they'll get done, you know. So
right, keep your head down.
Yeah, just keep your head down and keep working, you know. That's how you get to the gold, is just by writing hours and hours of shit until you finally find one little nugget in there and you go, oh wow, this is actually a really good song.
Yeah.
But that's always been our writing process. It's just that now we've got more shit to, you know, sift through.
And when you've got that scheme, you can still work other jobs, and the scheme allows for that.
Yeah, it's like you can do casual work. You know, man, like I actually got a job a couple of months ago in like a big warehouse. And this, but just like as this JobKeeper payment started rolling in, and I was just like, I fucking hate this, you know. And that was probably the first time in my life. I worked there for 2 days. I worked there Wednesday, Thursday, and by the end of, on the start of Thursday, I was like, I'm going to have to quit this job pretty soon. I'll make it to the end of the week. And then by the end of Thursday, I was like, I'm not fucking coming. I'm not spending another minute of my life in this place.
What was the vibe then?
It was, you know, it was, the vibe was like, all right, it was pretty cool. Like, you know, very dry warehouse environment. You know, they were dealing with, like electronic equipment coming in and like sorting through it and scanning barcodes and like inspecting the equipment to make sure that it wasn't faulty. And, you know, just like 8 hours of that, you know, working on like a packaging line, basically, not packaging, you know, like a production line, which I've done before, but this one was just particularly boring. And it was just, and the vibe there was just so dry. And I was just like, fuck, like, it was the first time in my life where I was like, you know what? I don't have to work a job that I fucking hate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I've worked heaps of jobs that I've hated in the past and I stuck with them for years and like I hated it and it, you know, and it was awful. You know, it was awful for my, you know, emotional and psychological well-being. So who needs it?
I've had a few jobs where I've lasted a few days and people will be like, you know, family or friends will be like, oh, what? You know, you're not supposed to quit a job. Yeah. You're not allowed to quit a job.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I copped that a bit. And I was just like, I don't give a fuck, man. I hated that place.
And I think you hit a nail on head there where, you know, it's maybe quite a hard subject to bring up and have the almost confidence to say it sometimes, but you know when something is affecting your health and your well-being.
Yep.
You can feel it.
Yeah. And there's people who just fight through that, you know? Like that was like my father-in-law said to me, you know, when I quit this job, he was like, you know, I worked, you know, 30 years in a place and fucking, you know, like I've done all this stuff and I fucking hated it. And I was like, yeah, but like, that's not, is that a good thing? Like maybe you're wrong to have done that. Maybe you should have tried to, I didn't say this to him, of course, I thought this to myself, but I'm like, I don't want that for myself. I don't want to work 30 years in a job and fucking hate it the entire time.
And I just wonder, like, where does this come from? Like, does it come from this kind of like old British colonial like strength thing? Like, where does this come from? You know, because it exists.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know where it comes from, but, you know, I haven't thought about it too much, but I just fucking, I don't want to be a part of it anymore.
Fucking capitalism.
Yeah, I guess that's it. It's capitalism, but it's, you know, it's also this thing of like, you know, companies expecting you to be loyal to them when they aren't loyal to you. You know, there's this real,
right.
Yeah. I mean, I've never experienced it where a company's looked out more for its employees than they are for their bottom line. And it's just, you know, you do feel that a little bit sometimes. You're like, oh, this place is kind of looking after me. But then, you know, it'll come down to the crunch, you know, like a promotion or, you know, maybe that they're kicking people, you know, they're firing people and, you know, you're just left out in the lurch and you realize, fuck, like I've been like dedicating my time and my, you know, health, my psychological health to this company and they fucking like, it's, you know, they don't give a fuck.
Right. And what about our time here? Do you know what I mean? This is our time on earth as well. You know, you can't, I had a thing yesterday where I had like an onboarding for a job I'm starting and I emailed them, you know, just asking how long the meeting would be just because I had something to do afterwards. Another call. And like, I felt bad sending that email.
Yeah.
You know, I felt bad asking how long this meeting is going to be. Why? Why should I feel fucking bad about that?
Yeah.
You know, that's how humans communicate, by asking questions, you know, and you shouldn't be scared to ask questions in the workplace.
Yeah. And like, you're interviewing them just as much as they are interviewing you. You know, if there's one thing I've learned from working a million jobs is that some of them suck. And you know, like, yeah, you know how it gets to that point in the interview where they're like, now, do you have any questions for us? What I've started doing now is I go, yeah, what's it like to work at your company? Like, I use a specific term. I go, like, what's the culture like?
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah,
I mean, I've only done it in a couple of interviews recently, but it's like, that's the best, you know, that then like the places that I was going for, that's when they started talking. They go, oh, you know, it's great. You know, I hang out with this person and blah, blah, blah. Mm. You know, and it's like, and you go like, fuck, all right, okay, this might actually be a cool place to work, because that's what you need, right? You need, I feel like I've been thinking about this recently, like there's like three, maybe more, but there's three main aspects to a good job, and that's money, people, and whether or not you like the work you're doing. And I feel like you can get away with like, one or if a job has one or two of those things, you can get away with not having the third, but you can't. But if a job, if you hate what you're doing, you're not getting paid that much, and you don't like any of the people you're working with, it's like, it's not a good job. Don't work that job. Quit immediately. That would be my advice.
Right on, because you're only going to make yourself worse for it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shit job, obviously, you know? Like, yeah. you don't need to do that. You need something, you know. Go and get a job shoveling shit with your friends. You know what I mean? It might not pay that much. You might not love the work, but you can just hang out with your mates, and that's good. That's a good job, I think.
And labouring jobs get quite well paid in Australia, don't they? I mean, they get paid well here as well, but I think from people I've known in Australia, the cash in hand there is a lot better than here.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's, I've got quite a few friends who do laboring and trade jobs, and, you know, I think there is still similar issues here as there is in London. But I had a mate who worked in London for a time as a plasterer just last year, actually. And he just couldn't get by with the amount of money the amount of money to live in London, and then the amount of money he was getting paid as a laborer. He was just like no one can do this.
Yeah, I feel for the people who, I grew up in the suburbs, so I kind of knew where could be cheap, you know, and lots of people don't know I guess they're little tricks, aren't they? You know, knowing the little areas of town where it's cheap rent, but also transport's okay.
Yeah, that's it. You know, and I'm sure people would have the same issues living in Melbourne. You know, there'd be the same issues here, but I think there's a minimum wage here and it's not that bad. And I'm sure, you know, it's the most livable city in the world or something.
Do you have tipping culture in bars?
Nah, man. Fuck, I hate that. I hate that about America. What's with that?
That means people working behind the bars get paid well.
Yeah. Yes. Sometimes, if they're tipped well.
And it's only a dollar, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if anything, that culture will be benefiting the employers, because I mean, of course it is, because then there's a part of their staff's income is in these tips, which aren't taxed. So, you know.
But I think a lot of those tips go directly to the people serving you though.
Yeah.
People, I mean, at least people I know, you know, they don't show it to their bosses.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm dodgy on that. And I hate having to do it as well as a punter. Have you been there and like, have you had experiences where you've undertipped?
I don't think I've ever been called out on it.
Right.
But I certainly have forgotten.
Yeah, fuck.
And if I've remembered, then try and tip double next time. But I mean, for me, once I'm in the bar, you know, pretty hard to leave sometimes. You know, I'll be there for a while.
Yeah.
So I'll be paying enough, you know?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, like, it obviously it works for them. So
right.
It's the thing. But no, we don't have that here. I mean, people do tip, but only it's not. It's not expected as part of the bill,
right,
you know.
Right. What other jobs had you had then in the your bands before Press Club? Were they quite a big, you know, were you touring quite a lot? Were you on the road a lot?
I had done some touring before Press Club. Press Club's been sort of my main, the biggest band I've been in up to date. But you know, I played in like this Latin band, Colombia. Right. They do like Colombian, like kind of like reggae, that sort of stuff. That's another side of my playing. You know, I do kind of like, pretty good reggae drummer.
Sweet.
You know, as a kid growing up, you know, that was what I was into, like ska and punk.
Ska punk. Reggae, yeah, hell you know? Yeah.
So
Friends of Rom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Friends of Rom are sort of skate punk, but right.
Yeah, yeah. They're like sort of like Blink or something. Right. Pop punk. Ska is huge. There's a band H Block 101. If you wanna check out a cool Melbourne like classic punk ska band. They were awesome.
Hell yeah.
But these guys, we toured with, you know, the band The Cat Empire?
No, I don't.
Yeah, they're this like sort of similar kind of thing, like a world music band out of Melbourne. So I did a tour with them, and I did a couple of other things around Australia. But
what was that like, touring in a kind of world music band?
It was wild, man. Like there's so many of us, you know, like with Press Club, there's just four of us. And it's so easy, you know, you just go and hire a car and you can go anywhere. But like, there was like, at one point there was like 11 people in this band, you know, there's like a horn section and like backing singers and a percussionist and all this shit.
Great.
And
you were playing bars?
Yeah. Playing bars. You know, we did a couple of like bigger shows supporting other like Colombian acts that had come to town. And of course, this Cat Empire tour was pretty big. We did like Horden Pavilion in Sydney, which is like 5,000 people or something.
Wow!
Yeah, that was huge.
Holy shit,
that was huge.
Pressure on you, keeping it together.
Oh yeah, man. That vibe, like, you know, I feel like I've played a few shows like that, but that Horden Pavilion show, maybe it was because it was my first like big like, you know. What would you call that? Like that big 5,000 people. Like when
it's
like
concert. It's not, concert. Not a gig anymore. That's a concert. Nah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like you get out there and like you go and sit behind the drums and like you just see like blackness. Really, you go like, fuck, like what's going on out there? And like then you just hear the, and you're like, oh fuck, that's all people. Like I can't even see the back of the room. There's just all people everywhere. That was a moment, actually. That's a moment you never forget. Like the first time you go like, fuck, like that's 5,000 people. And I can't imagine what it'd be like to be playing at like fucking Wembley. Imagine that. I wonder if that's a different feeling or if it's just the same feeling, you know, you like whether it's 5,000 people or 100,000 people, you go, yeah, that's too many people to count, you know, like it just, you just reach a certain point. You're like, that's a lot. That's a big gig.
It's like money, you know, like £40,000 or 100. I mean, obviously that's the big jump there, but I don't know, 40 to 80,000 pounds is like,
yeah,
I don't know, man. I take both.
Yeah. Or it's like, if you had like, it's like, do you want $5 million or $5 billion? And you go, well, fuck, man. Like, either would be good.
I'll take the $5 million, man.
I don't care. They both sound really good. You know, they'd both sort me out.
And you always kind of maintained being able to be like, you know, live well and eat well, for example, and pay rent over the years.
Yeah, yeah, I have. I mean, okay, all right. Let's go through some of my jobs. I'll skip through to some ones that we might have a bit of a chat about. Up until recently, and you know, I might end up going back there as well. I've been working at a whiskey distillery.
Nice.
And that's been really cool, man. Like that's one of those jobs where the people were good, the pay was good, and I liked what I was doing. You know, I had like a connection to what I was doing. Like I was making this top shelf whiskey. You know, well, I wasn't making it. I shouldn't say that. I'm not a distiller. I was like filling. I was part of the production line, you know,
Expensive stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's this stuff, Starwood whiskey.
All right.
Yeah, expensive stuff. Like in Australia, it's like over $100 for a bottle.
Wow.
And I think it's even more. I think if you go to like the US, it's like almost $200 for a bottle.
Fuck.
But it was so cool, man. Like such a good vibe to the place. And you know, I just sit there with my headphone, like my Bluetooth headphones in, and just like filling up these barrels and like, you know, just listening to music, listening to podcasts, and days would just go by like a, you know, like nothing. And that was sort of one of the first times I was like, you know, if this music thing doesn't work out, I could do this.
You know? So when you're filling up the barrels, how does that work? Are you grabbing like the tube or the funnel?
Man, they put the spirit into like 20,000 liter tankers. You know, you like tankers, like maybe like 3 or 4 people tall, and you know, around maybe, you know, 2 or 3 people lying down is like the radius or the diameter. And then, so there's these big metal tankers, and then you attach a big hose to it with a nozzle on the end, like, and the nozzle's like as big as your leg. And then you just like, you wash all these barrels, and then you just shove the things in, the nozzle in, and you just blast it. And it's probably going at like, maybe like 10 liters a second. It's like blasting out of this hose. Like, and you know, you stand there, and it takes, you know, to fill like a 300 liter barrel, it takes about like a minute and a half or something like that.
Wow. That's heavy. That's a heavy fucking barrel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can sort of move them, like you can kind of move them around when they're not full. But once they're full, you need a forklift. And it's like they go on these like holders, right? So you can stack them. And if the barrel's like not quite aligned properly before you fill it up, then you're fucked. Because now you've got like this, you know, these barrels, you can't move them at all. And you got to like try and like, you know, stack them on top of each other. And then like you're stacking them like these 300 liter barrels, and you're stacking them like to the roof of a warehouse. And like if one of them on the bottom is like wonky, then the whole stack kind of just like tilts to the right. And you stand there going, like, oh, fuck, man. Like this is.
Oh, man. Have you seen any accidents with that?
Not with one of those tipping, but like, yeah, there's been a couple of close calls, stuff falling off trucks and stuff. I think that's just working in a warehouse is like that. There's always just that thing of like, every once in a while, a little thing will happen, and everyone goes, "Fuck!" Like someone maybe could have died just then. That's the one thing I think that I couldn't deal with working in a warehouse is like that constant thing in the back of your mind where like, fuck, I'm working with these big machines and this big stuff, you know, big crates, whatever it is you're working with. And like, fuck, you know, like I could die. One of these things could kill me, you know.
100%. And you hear about it. Like, you know, you hear about people losing arms and stuff. That's scary shit.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, that's the one. And like, I'm not a particularly like careful or like dexterous person. So if someone's going to die, it's probably going to be me. You know what I mean? If out of the, you know, if there's 3 people working in a warehouse and I'm one of them, I reckon I got odds on me to be the one to get hurt. You know what I mean?
I mean, that's why it's like, it's quite traditionally those jobs are fairly well paid, right? I mean, like,
yeah. Yeah, I don't know if anything's worth that though.
For you as a drummer or, you know, as a musician, it's pretty, that's a risk, you know, the thing that you love.
It's heavy. Yeah. Yeah, like you chop off a finger or something. Like this job's not worth fucking not being able to play drums for. That's the only issue about that.
Many question it now. Many question go back to it.
Yeah, no, I will if you know. Watch this space. We'll see what happens.
And any other jobs that have like had that impact on the way that you, you know, the way that you see things or the way you see yourself?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the first, like we talk about jobs that you hate earlier, you know, and I've always done a bit of teaching, you know, like teaching instrumental music to like one-on-one lessons with kids. And what I learned after doing that for years, you know, like I think I taught, maybe I taught in primary schools for like 3 or 4 years. And what I learned was that I hated it from the very first second I started. You know, I hated working with and being responsible for little kids. Like I'm pretty good with kids, you know, like I'm, you know, we get along, but you know, there's like that, you know, like a primary school teacher, because I've met a lot of primary school teachers working in primary schools, and you know, they all have this thing where it's like they love that. I mean, hopefully some of them do have this thing where they love kids and like seeing them develop and like working with them on this, you know, really easy shit, but you know, for them it's hard, and you know, you get to see them, you know, develop over time. And I just don't have that. I don't have that instinct in me of like, you know, trying to get them to, you know, being proud of them for being able to do these things. In my head, I'm just like, fuck, like I can already do this stuff. And I just don't have the patience to try and help other people get there. I think it's easier. I've done a little bit of teaching with like adults and like older kids, and it's easier with them. You know, I think they just pick things up faster. Mm. So you can sort of direct them in a particular direction if they want to be, you know, if they want to be playing a particular song or doing a particular thing with music.
But if with they little know kids, what song they want to learn as a cover or.
Yeah, exactly. Like little kids, you go like, oh, what's your favorite song? They go, I don't know.
Well, it requires a lot of patience. And I think it's okay to, I mean, I think it's okay to not have patience sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's human.
Yeah. And you know, some people are better at things than others, you know,
mm-hmm.
And some people have a passion for things that I don't. And that's great. That's yeah. Perfect because, you know, that's not something I want to do.
And you know that, you know, you've had that experience, like you take that as a positive thing, you know, you know that you don't really want to do that again. That's cool. That's yeah. Good.
And having worked in those places for, you know, four years or however long I spent teaching kids gave me the insight to when I went to that warehouse job a few months ago, I realized, this is giving me that same feeling. I'm not doing this again.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I know that feeling of being like, nah, this isn't right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man, but
that's interesting.
You know, it's what it is. You know, hopefully now I'll be able to find a good job.
Are you pretty open about, you know, what things you're going to do next, cash in hand?
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. Like I've spent a lot of, I've worked in some libraries.
Cool.
And I've done some study in that area as well. And, you know, I love that work, you know, it's not dangerous, like working in a warehouse. You don't have to deal with, you don't have to deal with like classrooms with the kids, you know, you just kind of stack shelves and help people with printers and,
yeah,
you know, help people access the internet and shit. You know, I think that's the kind of thing I want for the future, you know, low risk, low pressure.
Yeah.
And like, so when I, this is diverting a little bit, but when I got out of high school, you know, like I, being a musician, I went and started working in pubs. And, when I moved to I lived in West Melbourne for a little bit, just next to the city. And I, went around to all the pubs in the area and gave out my resumes. And this one dude was like, yeah, come in and do like a trial shift on Saturday. I was like, all right. So I rock up on Saturday, like 6 p.m. or something. And he was like, yeah, this is what you do. Da, da, da. He took me through the place like 10, 15 minutes. He's like, all right, see you later. And the place was empty. I was like, oh, like, are you not staying? He's like, no. He's like, this is my night off. you know, I'll see you later. And so he just put me, and so I just went and sat behind the bar, right? And no one came in for the rest of the shift. I was like, fuck, you know. And so, and he'd said, you know, just take the money out of it, you know, take the money out of it, it was like cash in hand, out of the till when you're done. So I took the money out of the till, I locked up, and I went home. And I kept working at this place for like 2 years. It's called Jawa Bar. And nobody ever came in.
And no customers.
When I say nobody ever came in, I mean it was some people came in like off the street and like had drinks, but like there was no like regulars. There was no there was not a lot of like walk-in crowd. It was in a weird part of the city. And so, you know, I just worked in this, I was just working in this pub for ages with nobody there. You know, I'd go entire shifts, like 8 hours with nobody coming in.
But you're getting paid. That's not bad, man.
That's what I'm saying, man. Like that was a low job. Responsibility job, man. That was like low risk, low responsibility. I read so many books and just, and just chilled at this bar. You know, it's like that's sort of thing really gives you a like an appreciation for just hanging out on your own.
Did that get to a point, like did you leave there because it got just too easy?
No, man, this is how I left. Like I was driving somewhere. I think I was driving to another job that I was working at the same time. I think I was teaching at the same time, and I was driving to the school, and I got a text from the owner. Like I'd worked there for like 2 years by this point, like Friday and Saturday night every week for like 2 years. I got a text from the owner that said, bar closed. Like that, just two words, bar closed. And I was like, what the fuck? So I pulled over and I texted her back like what, forever? And she's like, yep. And then that was it. It was a weird joint, man. It was a weird operation that we were running. And so like,
get to the point, mate.
Yeah. And then I eventually went over there. She had like a closing down thing. And I was like, what the fuck happened? And she's like, well, you know, nobody ever came in and we couldn't pay rent. So they changed the locks on me. You know, I think she broke in to try and had like one last night illegally to try and sell off all the stock. And then amazing. That was it. That place, I don't know what that place is now. I think it's like a jewelry store or something. Oh man. No, hang on. Let me tell you one more story. So I was working at this bar, Jawa Bar, no one ever went to, and someone came in, right? He was like a big dude, he's maybe 7 foot tall. He's huge, Rob, but he came in a few times. And he said to me one time, you know, we got along. He said to me one time, hey man, do you like history? And I was like, yeah, I like history. And he's like, you know, like he knew I was a musician. He was like, do you want to come and, work for this guy that I work at doing like medieval recreations in schools? And so I was like, yeah, sure. And the dude gave me a ring. He gave this guy my number and he gave me a ring. And he's like, yeah, come down to this school like tomorrow or something. Went down there and the dude, like, you know, we went down to this school, found what I assumed was the medieval recreation crew in like their fucking pantaloons and shit, and they handed me like the garb, you know, the pointy shoes and like the pantaloons and stuff, and you know, go and get changed in the toilet and shit. And then I just spent, you know, again, I worked with these guys for like a year or two, you know, getting up at like 5 in the morning to get to these schools, sometimes, you know, well out of Melbourne, like doing like helping out with like sword fighting.
Like reenactments.
Yeah, man. Like that was like an educational educational things in schools where that, you know, the medieval crew comes in and like runs like workshops on like different aspects of medieval life. And so I like learned all this shit about and, you know, was helping these people present these things on like sword fighting and like medieval music, like I'd like teach these kids to do like these medieval dances and like all joining hands and like, you know, dancing around the room and shit. It was so funny, man. It was so funny.
Learn a lot yourself?
Yeah, heaps. Heaps. I've got a really surprisingly good understanding of what medieval life was like.
That's excellent. Have you seen that film, Role Models?
Yeah, man. Yeah, it was like that. It wasn't quite like that. But these people were into that shit. That stuff is pretty crazy, man. Have you ever seen that shit in real life?
Never. I used to live in a place where you'd get people dress up and walk around like that. But okay. I haven't seen like the reenactment thing, the acting.
And like the actual fighting that they do. They call it LARPing, live action role play. Man, like one time we were going past Princess Park in Melbourne. We saw him doing it. And like the first thing I saw was like this guy like throwing a spear like fucking hard as and it hitting someone in the back. Like, fuck, they take it seriously.
But it wasn't like a pool noodle. It was like an actual like kind of heavy.
I think they got like foam ends to them or something. And like it's like an honesty system and a point system. Like, you know, if you get hit with the back with a spear, then it's time to like go and sit on the bench.
Oh man, I love that. The honesty system.
Yeah.
I think that's got to be one of the best jobs on here, Frank.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be able to talk about it more, but you know, we might have to wrap up.
Yeah. I mean, thanks so much for coming on though. I mean, what are the next few months for you looking like?
Man, we're just writing music. As soon as we get back together, it might take us like maybe 2 months or so to get the songs together and to get it all ready to go and record. So hopefully we'll be recording by the end of the year, but I reckon that's real hopeful.
And that's the third album.
Third album, hopefully, unless we break up before then.
Do you know what it's going to sort of, do you have like a sound in mind? Have you got some references?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we've had this time off now and we've been talking and thinking a lot about what it is we want to be going for with the songwriting and the sound on this album. And I think, you know, we've got this thing down where, you know, we've got like the fast, loud, screaming punk thing. We got that down on lock. So we're trying to add some more dynamics into the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
At this point, just in the songwriting stage, you know, try and really get to the heart of songs and you know, instead of just like bashing it out and you know, do it balls to the wall like we've been doing it in the past. Maybe we're thinking of, you know, maybe trying to add some shades of darkness and dynamic to the whole thing.
Great.
I don't know how it's going to go. We might end up just releasing another Balls of the Wall punk album, but we're going to try and shift up our color palette a little bit.
Even those small shifts, you can really like they do make such a difference, you know, on a record.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes you end up defining those changes and new records. From, you know, one or two songs, just one or two songs that you go, fuck, like that's a real departure and is really cool, you know. But we'll see how it goes. I'm really liking at the moment just writing.
Awesome. Have you got a name for it, the record?
No, not at all, not as yet. I mean, we came up with the first album. I wanted to call. Fuck, what did I want to call it? Songs to Sing By, Music to Drum To, or some shit like that. And it's always been an ongoing joke. So the working title at the moment is Songs to Sing By, Music to Drum To. And so if it does end up getting named that, you heard it here first. But I doubt it will.
All right, Frank, thank you so much. It's been great to chat.
Yeah, you too, Giles.
Awesome, man. I've been working all day, bobbing my head on the side, running around like a blue ass fly. I've been working, yeah, I've been working all day.
This is a Mighty Moon Media podcast.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.